Universities are broken, say a group of academics, philanthropists, journalists and artists. For too long, they say, faculty have been treated like thought criminals for having a wrong opinion about hot-button issues such as immigration or gender differences. And the fearless pursuit of truth, which we associate with universities, is at the mercy of this new term, wokeness. So they are starting their own university, the University of Austin in Texas, and among the founding faculty will be Dr. Peter Boghossian, who resigned his position as an assistant philosophy professor at Portland State University in September, saying that university was no longer a bastion of free inquiry, but rather a social justice factory. And Peter Boghossian joins me now. Hello there.
Hi, pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, nice to chat to you. What were some of your first experiences in the university classroom that indicated things were changing on campus?
I think my first experiences actually weren't in the university classroom. They were in the environment around the university classroom. Constant barrages of emails about diversity, equity, inclusion. Stories that I would hear from faculty, which didn't seem to comport with any reality I knew about race, sexuality, orientation, sexual orientation, gender differences. And it was a slow creep. It's hard to say exactly when I realized it, maybe 2012, and then the escalation became rather extreme from there. But personally, it didn't happen for me in the classroom. That wasn't the first time I noticed the creeping wokeism and eventually the ultimate takeover of the institution.
You had a couple of occasions where I think students reacted unexpectedly to talks you were giving.
I think they reacted quite expectedly, actually. They went berserk. They didn't engage the arguments they were presented with. They became cry bullies, as the term indicates, that they shrieking, and it wasn't just students, mind you. In fact, it was spearheaded by faculty members. Faculty members who not only could not substantively engage in argument themselves, but they taught their students that to disrupt, and there's a body of literature for this from the gender theorist Judith Butler, they disrupt events, and you can watch these online. And it was pretty extreme from even in 2014 when the SWAT team, I don't know if you have SWAT teams in New Zealand, but they're just like heavily armored and shielded police officers who had to surround us and private bodyguards. And it was unbecoming of a university, to say the least.
And can you give people an example of the sorts of things that students and in many cases other faculty members objected to, just so we know what we're talking about here?
Well, they objected to any and everything that didn't toe the party line. In fact, they objected to even saying the other side of an issue, even being presented with, for example, so I guess a little context is necessary here. I don't teach math. I teach philosophy. And within philosophy, many of my subjects were in ethics. And so one of the things that you try to do in ethics is you try to give the most charitable case of all positions so then you can kind of map out the reasoning behind it. And it's called the epistemology, or how someone claims to know what they think they know. And so this was most conspicuous in the realm of trans issues. So trans bathrooms, trans women in sports, trans women-only spaces, people born biologically men who at some level of either transition or self-declaration want to go into women's prisons or women's-only spaces. So those were the items or the issues that were most hotbed, but there were many, many other hotbed issues. But almost all of those revolved on race, gender, and sexual orientation. And then later on, they became political ideas about Trump and the election, et cetera.
Yeah. And there's so much to talk about here. And because this is 2021, I want to make it really explicit that you are not necessarily the right-wing, reactionary conservative type who are saying you should be allowed to say, well, maybe you do believe this, but it's not coming from a place of racism, or that you don't believe in gender equality, that you don't like transgender people. Because often we have a tendency when we hear someone objecting to the way things are done, we think, well, he's a baddie. And that we do that more and more often these days, I think.
Right. And thanks for pointing that out. So I want to say a few things about that. Emphatically, unconditionally, and unequivocally, I support gay rights, trans rights. I am vehemently and adamantly opposed to any kind of discrimination on the basis of skin color. And it's almost a shame that that has to be said, because those who are against free speech and open inquiry and discourse have crafted a narrative that if you question or challenge any of their claims, you are somehow a racist, a Nazi, a bigot. And that's unfortunate, because that's just a way to weaponize accusation to prevent dialogue and discourse. And so that's not what this is about. This is about the university and students within a university being able to ask questions and inquire freely, and the faculty members not looking at the university as an ideology mill, but a place where they can come together to facilitate constructive dialogue about contentious topics. And we don't have that now. We have people who are absolutely hell-bent on teaching people. They walk into classes knowing, or at least believing that they know, that they have the right answers to moral questions. And then they test students on that to make sure that students have replicated or given back to them their own ideology. You do this enough, and what you have is a faculty who call out people who don't agree with them. You know, first they came for the conservatives, and they came for the classical liberals, and they came for the classical liberals, and then they came for me. So there's a threshold here. But this is not about let me say what this is about. This is about open inquiry and free examination of really contentious topics, in which the university should be exactly the place where that's done.
Yeah, I was at university 25 years ago, and my favorite course was called Social and Moral Philosophy. It was a first year course, and we went in and one week we would do abortion, and the next week we'd do animal rights, and then the next week we'd do affirmative action. And the job of the excellent lecturer was not to convince us one way or the other, but to show us how the arguments were constructed and what it boils down to. For example, you know, how you feel on abortion really comes down to this fine point of where you believe life begins. And I got something out of that, and I'm not sure my position was changed on any of the moral issues we were talking about, but that's not really the point, is it? What is the value of teaching students how an argument is constructed and how to take it apart if necessary?
I think what you see happening now is this idea that students are taught that if they shouldn't even hear the other side of an issue, they shouldn't even be asked to engage with those arguments, because there's something fundamentally wrong with those arguments and engaging it. The word they use is platforming, that you're giving those arguments a platform. So when you really think about how monstrous that is, it's almost as if, or in fact, it is that the university is designed for when students come in to reinforce the beliefs they already have. Right. So one of the things that you said is you hear the arguments, you examine the arguments, and the key piece that was missing in that is that the professor pushes back on your position no matter what it is. Mm. And often what I used to do is I used to say, okay, who's for, you know, this, you know, death penalty, what have you, Muslim immigration is a great one that you also can't talk about nowadays. And then I'd have everybody raise their hand. And then I'd put them in the other half of the classroom and have them argue against their positions. So that's lost now. That is a method that we have used since Socrates, the dialectic, you know, counterexamples, thinking through. It's in a sense, the essence of the Socratic method. But when you think that you have the truth, you no longer rely on those methods. And you also no longer look to the scientific method to find truths about the world. Why would you if you have your own ideology?
And to jump out of university campuses for a moment, there might be something to be said for that in normal life at the moment. In New Zealand, people find themselves arguing about a lot of the same sorts of things you're arguing about in the US. Front of mind at the moment is vaccination. So is there some value in someone who believes in the COVID vaccine taking the best arguments of the anti-vaccine lobby or belief system? Or are there certain circumstances where you say, well, they're just being anti-science, so we're not going to engage with them rationally? You know, how do we take these sort of learnings from the university classroom and use them in real life?
It's a great question. I actually co-authored an entire book about that called How to Have Impossible Conversations. This is my last book. Mm-hmm. And so if you don't talk to somebody, what's the alternative? The only alternative is really bloodshed. So we have to start creating cultures in which we talk to people, particularly across political and moral divides. Unfortunately, right now, a large number of people not only do not want to talk to people about it, but think about this move for a second. So for the longest time, and I'm not saying this was ubiquitous, but for the longest time, if people had a difference of opinion about a moral issue, often what you'd see, and you can look, and this goes way back to Plato's Theaetetus, in which Socrates has a discussion about what knowledge is. Often it was, this person doesn't know something, and then therefore this person's belief is wrong. But now, if people have a difference of opinion, particularly a moral opinion, it's not that they don't know something, it's that they believe it because they're bad people. Yeah. So the whole way that we think about these problems has shifted. So it's not merely the COVID vaccine one way or the other, it's that people have these beliefs not because they're ignorant or not because they trust scientific authorities or over-reliance upon them, but because they're just bad people. And once you start crafting that narrative, then you've really cemented your own doom.
I suspect that the stuff that you enjoy about philosophy is some of the stuff that I enjoy, you know, thinking back to the university days, the rhetorical flourishes and the logical deconstruction and this tradition of Western liberal values and using those values to weigh up competing arguments. Do you at least concede, though, that some progress has been made and some new understanding has been made in the world of academia, that actually the perspective of the person making the argument counts, that hurt feelings or actual historical harm is worth including in the conversation, that sometimes there will be issues that you try and address in these very dry logical manners, and if you do that, you perhaps minimize the harms or the perspectives of the people directly affected by those issues?
Okay, well, there was a lot packed into that statement.
I was trying to put the best version of the argument together, you know.
Yeah. So there's multiple things going on in that at once. You know, do I at least concede or do I concede? I can't remember exactly how you framed it. It depends what you mean. If you mean, I don't think there's anybody, at least nobody I've ever heard argue it. Maybe somebody in the middle of nowhere speaking to himself, but I have personally never heard an argument from anybody who says that there was not historical injustice, who said that the way that we treated African Americans and homosexuals, et cetera, was not horrific and truly terrible. Like, I've never heard that. So bracket that for a second. Then the issue becomes, to what degree should we take somebody's feelings into account when having a conversation? Well, that's another question. You didn't say that explicitly, but I pulled that from the issue. I pulled that from what you said. And if you're having a conversation with your friends, it depends what the conversation is about in the context. If you're in a romantic partnership, it's always probably different, but feelings have to play some kind of a role. You know, we have this idea that, I don't know if you've watched Star Trek as a kid, but, you know, we have this idea of Spock, the ultimately rational person, yeah. And then he shuts off his emotions and all Vulcans. Well, that's ahistorical. There's no historical context for that whatsoever. So that is his, that is ahistorical. You know, that was a character who, by Gene Roddenberry, who created this show. But a lot of people, they think, well, if you're really logical and rational, you must shut off your emotions. But that's not, again, going back to Socrates, that's not what Socrates says at all. He says, as long as reason is the head of the chariot, it's like a chariot, and as long as reason is driving the chariot, the desire, emotion, et cetera, play some role. I would argue that in a philosophy classroom, when you're trying to figure out what truth is, that we have to try to minimize our feelings, and we have to look to what the evidence is. So any examination of the evidence should be feeling neutral. Right. So if I'm trying to figure out if the earth is warmed by carbon and if it's anthropogenic and to what degree it's warmed by carbon, my feelings are totally irrelevant and they should be irrelevant. Now, if you're talking about basing policies, which we do, on the evidence, now that's different. That's an entirely different beast. Who is this going to affect? Is it going to be in poor neighborhoods? What is the consequence economically? What is the consequence, you know, across class and racial lines? Okay, so those are separate questions. But as a rule, almost a rule, there could be exceptions. I just can't think of any off the top of my head. But when you're trying to figure out what truth is, particularly truth about the world, truth about what kind of societies we should construct, truth about human flourishing, you have to move your feelings to the side so you can take a look at all of the positions and all of the evidence. Only after you've done that in a sincere investigation, okay, this is what these people believe, you know, maybe this is how they feel about this. Once you've done that, you're better positioned. But the moment you start taking your feelings into account, your feelings are not only subjective, but they're capricious on an hourly basis. So you can't root an examination of truth on the way you feel about something. Nobody would remain in relationships.
Yeah. And yet I think, and perhaps this is where you depart from people who disagree with you, is that I think a lot of people listening, for example, would feel a little uncomfortable with the idea of, say, you and I arguing for and against affirmative action to help a particular minority group, while a member of that minority group stands by and you and I say, well, you don't have any particularly helpful perspective on this because of being from this group. We're going to argue according to the Western liberal tradition and reason this out.
I'm not sure I follow. I mean, if you argue according to the liberal tradition, then everybody is allowed to participate and speak, and all voices can be heard. Everybody has,
but no special perspective or special weight given to the views of someone who's affected or has been affected by the issues that you're discussing.
Well, I don't know. Maybe. I mean, they have testimonial accounts, and we should certainly listen to people's testimonial accounts. But how do you adjudicate an issue if, like, so let's say, for example, I want to figure something out, and I have the heartfelt testimony of many, many African Americans who say they've been pulled over by the police disproportionately. Okay, so how do you adjudicate that? Well, what you do is you look at the evidence, right? You look at body cams, you look at when the police, I'm not an expert in, you know, anything dealing with the police, but, you know, when the police call in, you know, they look at someone's license and you correlate that to someone's race and self-identification. I mean, there are tools of science and survey data that we can use to figure out those questions. And when there's a conflict between a person's feelings and what the evidence is, we have to defer to the evidence. We just have to.
What is the hope for the University of Austin?
The hope is that we can make something new, is that we can build something extraordinary. And I think we're doing that. We're building a university based upon freedom of thought, freedom of expression, and classical texts. So you don't read about what somebody else said about somebody else, what they wrote about someone 500 years ago. You actually read, you know, those translated classical texts. So the hope is that we can create an environment in which we can push back on students' beliefs, that we can make it a virtue to say, I don't know, when you don't know the answer to a question, that we can value changing our minds about ideas and topics, that we can explore and examine some of the most controversial and frankly, exciting and maybe even dangerous topics. And we can do so in a way that's civil and respectful of the people, and maybe even grow some very deep and very profound friendships as a result of that. You know, Aristotle talks about types of friendships, and he says, you know, one of the highest forms of friendship is people who like good conversation. The highest form of friendship, you know, you like conversation, I like conversation. The highest conversation is between two virtuous people. And so if somebody loves the truth and someone wants to figure out the truth and they value changing their own mind, they value discourse, that's the kind of institution we want to create. We want to create a shining city on a hill.
It's been great talking to you, Peter. Thank you very much for your time today. We hope we can have you back in New Zealand at some point in the future. Until then, good luck and thanks for your time.
Thanks. I appreciate it.